This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. If you're a regular listener of NPR, you've probably heard Hari Kondabolu. He's a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and he's been a guest on Fresh Air, Morning Edition, All Things Considered 1A, Code Switch, and Q. He's a stand-up comic who's been called one of the most exciting political comics in stand-up by none other than the New York Times. He'll be here in Cincinnati on Friday, June 9th, headlining at the Taft Theater on tour to support his new comedy special called Vacation Baby. Joining me now in this recorded interview to add Cincinnati Edition to the storied list of public radio programs that have had him on as a guest is stand-up comedian and writer Hari Kondabolu. Welcome, Hari.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. I appreciate it. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. Taft Theater is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. So, Hari, in preparing for this interview, I got to do some really fun homework. I watched your Vacation Baby special and your documentary, The Problem with Apu. Let's talk about Vacation Baby first. How, if at all, has being a dad changed the way you look at your comedy and even the way you think about your own parents?
I mean, in terms of the comedy part, I feel like it's given me license to be more personal in my act, which is something I really should have given myself much earlier. I've always been like more comfortable talking about larger social issues and letting the audience kind of figure out who I am by what I talk about. And I've made it a goal to be more personal for a few years. And having a kid during the pandemic, that became my whole life. And by making this special about that experience, I gave the audience more of myself than historically I have. And so it was just a lot of growth because it was unavoidable. You can't not talk about a global pandemic if you haven't addressed it. And you can't not talk about having a kid. It's too big a thing. So, it allowed me a lot of freedom. And I'm very appreciative. Not of a pandemic happening, but of the ability to like have this outlet be this, being able to turn this hour into something personal. In terms of how I look at my own parents now, I think a lot of people probably have this experience. I'm going to stop blaming them for things. I'm going to stop saying I'm like this because you did that. Which still might be true, but the pressure all of a sudden I am understanding. It's your parents are the easy default for everything that you don't like about yourself. And, all of a sudden I'm like, wow, I expected so much out of them. And they, had their kids as immigrants in a new country. Like they had that added thing. So that's even harder than the weight that, just raising a kid in this country as an American is. So, and also trying to establish your life in America. So I'm much more grateful to them and much more understanding. And I felt that pretty quickly. Once you realize this human being is dependent on you and, their very existence, especially early on, is dependent on you as parents, it kind of changed how I view my parents completely. Yeah. I was very apologetic to them shortly after we had the kid.
For me, the concept of karma took on a whole new meaning.
Yeah.
once I was a parent. It's like, it's coming for me. It's brace for impact. Well, our listeners probably know you as a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, if not for all of your other work. Is that show as much fun to do as it sounds like?
Yes, it is absolutely as much fun as you think it is. Like, you're in front of a live audience. You have a panel of, at this point, I've been doing this enough years where it's usually a panel of friends, people I've done shows with, either Wait, Wait, or other shows that I have good chemistry with a host that is incredibly funny and good at his job. And we tape for, the show boils down to about an hour, but we're taping much more than an hour. I'm not even an hour with breaks and everything. So.
Right.
We're taping 2 hours and it's a laugh fest for most of it. I don't think the audience who listens at home understands what was cut out of the show. It's usually stuff that is very, it's like, it just wouldn't be on NPR. Like there's just things that like you would not hear on NPR either because of content or language. And it's such a fun live show. And then, of course, what you get as an edited product is great, too. But honestly, the chemistry and the dynamic of that live event has always been really fun to do.
Well, it sounds great. Going to one of those live productions is definitely on my bucket list. You've been doing stand-up since you were a teenager, right? Talk about how your comedy and your approach have changed over all those years.
I mean, it's strange to think about because I'm 40 now and I've been collecting my thoughts to share with people for, you know, more than half my life. Like it's my adolescence. It's my adulthood. Like this is how, you know, I've viewed the world for the majority of it now, majority of my life. You know, early on, I did comedy because I knew I was funny and I knew I wasn't nervous about being in front of people. And I was 16, 17 and didn't know any better. And also I couldn't play the guitar and I wanted girls to like me. And my poetry that I did write when I was that age made people laugh. So I knew, okay, comedy is probably the angle. These were earnest poems, by the way. This was earnest teenage love poetry. So, you know, I think, you know, knowing I had this public space to just be funny and, you know, create something, like it was remarkable. So for me, I just wanted to make people laugh. So a lot of my comedy, that was really the bottom line. If it's making people laugh, it doesn't matter what it is that I say. The idea of personal boundaries or lines or, you know, an ethos wasn't there. Like, I don't think comedy really does have boundaries or lines, like officially, but every person has their things they will and won't do and has an approach. And I didn't have one really. And after 9/11, as I'm seeing the world with a very different lens, with a much more politicized lens, you know, I'm seeing race in a different way. I'm seeing politics in a different way. I'm seeing the government in a different way. I'm a much more critical being. I started writing stand-up that reflected that and, you know, started to figure out what it is I wanted to do with my art. And one thing was the idea of do no harm. You know, like, I don't want to make things worse for people. Mm. I want to uplift people. I also thought about who am I targeting? It should be the people with power. It should be the things that are unfair. Like, I don't want to make someone's life who's hard enough even worse by treating them as a target for humor. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that, you know, at 17 or 18, I was not equipped to do. And as I've gotten older, certainly, like, you know, it's still a challenge. You know, it's not to say that, like, I'm bored of talking about race and I'm bored of, you know, talking about the big issues of the world, but to be able to, you know, do it for an hour and still keep an audience focused, you know, it's still as hard as it was when I was 25, 26. Like, it has taken a lot of work to figure out how to say things I greatly care about and have an audience buy in and not be afraid to laugh. And it's hard. It's incredibly hard, but it's what I love to do.
I want to talk a little bit more about that. Your comedy tackles these themes of race and bigotry and religion. We have a little bit of audio from your Vacation Baby special that we want to play.
I should let you know at this point, I'm a Hindu, or as it's pronounced in America, Muslim. The fear with that joke is there might be someone who's like, hey man, why did he say Muslim twice? Is he a double Muslim?
I mean, just so funny. But how do you hit the mark so you are so funny and not preachy with this kind of humor?
That's a great question. I mean, that literally is my issue every single time I think of something that's close to the heart or that I'm passionate about. You know, when I was, you know, like I was talking about earlier, right after 9/11, when I started to write more political ideas, for lack of a better word, you know, things about society, I was a college kid. And what are college kids like when they learn something and they're fired up? They do become kind of preachy, you know, because it's new to them and they're excited to use any platform that's available to them. And so, you know, early on, like, I'm definitely on stage and I think I forgot about punchlines. I forgot about what the purpose of me as a stand-up comedian was. You can say whatever it is you want to say, but the audience only allows you to do it if you fulfill the promise of a punchline. And early on, I did not have that. And it took years of trial and error. It took, you know, me living in Seattle as an immigrant rights organizer doing comedy at night, and testing out material with different audiences to start to understand, like, how do I keep this stuff, you know, how do I make these things relatable to people who might not think about some of the issues I think about? How do I find ways to make it funny when it's about to get a little too serious? How do I keep an audience focused? You know, because I realize that there is this line I like to play, you know, this game I like to play where I try to make people uncomfortable and then pull them out of the discomfort, because the discomfort is where I like to hold the truth, where I like to hold the things that I feel strongest about. And that punchline is kind of my bailout. It's the stuff that lets me say the other things. And, you know, sometimes I give too much of a setup. I give too much information because the audience doesn't know. And if it's too much, you know, because the audience isn't going to laugh. And if you figure out the exact amount of language, the amount of time while you still have them, you know, a punchline is more likely to be successful. And so, you know, that's just trial and error. That's the willingness to fail over and over and over again and develop a thicker skin. And it's not to say it still doesn't frustrate me when a joke misses, but I'm also aware that whether you're an open micer or Jim Gaffigan, you're going to be working out new material, and it's all part of the process. So it's trial and error.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking in this recorded interview with stand-up comedian and writer Hari Kondabolu. You are headlining this show on June 9th at the Taft Theater in Cincinnati, as I mentioned. In your new comedy special, Vacation Baby, you point out the jokes that you did not tell in Richmond, Virginia. Have you decided whether those jokes will fly in Cincinnati?
Well, I'll say two things. One, with regards to Cincinnati and the Taft Theater, I am very excited about this show because it's actually the last show I played before the pandemic was in Cincinnati at the Taft Theater.
Oh, wow.
In March of 2020. And I canceled rest of my tour literally after that show. And I think we all knew this might be the last time we go out, and probably were a little nervous. Should we be going out at all? And it was still kind of, we were still figuring out how COVID worked exactly. And I had such a connection with that audience, and maybe it was just an incredible audience and I got lucky, or maybe it was all of us feeling the same thing. Like, this might be the last one for a while, so let's go out with a bang. But it was a show I thought about for 2 years. I literally have thought about Cincinnati and the Taft Theater for 2 years while I was, you know, having this kid with my partner, while I was, you know, worried about COVID, spraying down food with chemicals so we didn't catch anything, wearing all sorts of different masks. Like, I thought about the Taft Theater in Cincinnati. So I trust Cincinnati. I don't need to worry about cutting anything. I feel good about what, you know, what I'm going to be able to do in that room in the city. In terms of material I cut from the special, I mean, the truth is, you know, I say that's not a joke I did in Richmond. I didn't do that in Richmond. The truth is, the jokes that are, you know, perhaps some of the edgiest, I did absolutely do in Richmond. I would do them anywhere. But the thing is, I wanted the audience to see vulnerability. I wanted the audience to, you know, kind of allow me to be a hypocrite. Because I think, especially when you're doing material, and you asked me this earlier, how do you prevent it from being self-righteous? Part of it is also to show that you're a human being too. And you're not as brave and as smart and as perfect as you're trying to come across, that you have fears and you make mistakes and you're constantly learning. And that's definitely early on in my career. I don't think I did enough of, like, I'm a human being, I'm relatable, and I also believe these things strongly. And that's why I put that stuff in, even though it's not true. Like, honestly, I'm not gonna edit something important in a set because of where I'm at. You just hope the people that are there will try to stick with you. Maybe it's not for everyone, but it's for the people it's for. And if it's not for you, hopefully it will be by the end of it. So that's kind of why I did that.
Well, that's great. And as someone who grew up in Queens, right, this incredibly diverse place, what do you make of the Midwest and cities like Cincinnati or Louisville when you tour?
I mean, it's always fascinating to see what diversity is. Because in Queens, diversity meant a broad range of racial groups and different classes and, you know, immigrant statuses. Like, it's a pretty broad thing to say what diversity is. And you had examples of that growing up in New York and in Queens in particular. Sometimes I travel the country and diversity just sounds like, it looks to me like it's white and black. And when people talk about race, they talk about white and black. And it's kind of a fascinating thing to walk into because I'm kind of this weird outlier as a South Asian, as an Asian American, who almost feels like I'm thrown. It's like entering, like you overhear a fight midway through and you have to pick a side and you're not exactly sure what's going on, but you got to figure it out quick and pick your side. It kind of feels like that when you're not black or white. So diversity is, it means different things in different places and it means different things to different audiences. So I never know. Like there are times I'll do shows and it feels like the most diverse crowd the city I'm in has had in years. And, you know, I'll have people come up to me and say, I've never been in a room with so many different types of people before in this city. And it makes me feel good that I'm creating this space that a broad range of people feel comfortable in and are going to laugh in. And even if they don't share a lot, they will share, you know, that hour with me. Yeah. So, I mean, that's how I treat it. And even if it's not the most diverse setting, I'm still happy to play for people who, you know, want to hear what I'm going to say and what I'm going to do.
Yeah. I know you've had to talk a lot about the problem with Apu to the point where you might be a little sick of it. Well, I really enjoyed the documentary. I thought it was a terrific film. What did you hope to accomplish with the film? And do you feel like you succeeded?
I mean, what I hoped to accomplish was to, you know, make a film that would start a critical conversation about like representation and minstrelsy and how has it worked historically and how it works specifically in for my community in this country. The goals weren't particularly lofty. And to be honest, the topic itself, even, you know, as someone who made the film, wasn't all that interesting to me because, you know, the show had been there 20 plus years. You know, I'm in my 30s. The world is changing. It was more of like, to me, a review of something that shaped many of us who grew up as South Asian American in this country. And the result, I mean, I'm happy it did start a conversation, but the quality of the conversation, for the most part, has been disappointing. Mm. It's people talking about the film who haven't seen the film. The film being serving as almost, you know, it's like a template we have for discussions about political correctness. You can't say anything anymore. And I was the example for a while there. Like this film is an example of everything that's wrong. And these are people that haven't seen the film. You know, there were people writing about it and talking about it around the world when the film was only available in the US for a really long time. And, you know, I don't think all of them were downloading this off torrents. You know, like this was literally people seeing a trailer and having judgments and people assuming what my arguments were going to be and making arguments that were already covered in the film. In addition to, you know, death threats and all the other stuff that came out of this, where I had to have extra security at shows and certainly had to stop using social media for a while. I knew there would be some pushback. I don't think I realized the complexity of the pushback. The idea that, you know, not only was I getting hate mail from people who, you know, feel like I stand for something that's ruining America, political correctness. You can't say what you want anymore. Like woke culture, whatever catchphrase is in at this particular moment of the discourse, you know what I mean? So I realized that. But when I started getting hate mail in Spanish and in Portuguese and in other languages, I started to realize, oh, this is even more complicated than I thought, because The Simpsons in other countries is still very popular. It's still a huge show. And how people in Brazil or Argentina or Colombia are watching the show, it might be dubbed in another language. The racial stereotypes read differently. As far as they're concerned, Apu just might be a character they like. Mm. Why are you taking away a character we like? Why is it that important to you? And so all that context is gone. So it became this really complicated and often ugly thing. And, you know, I'm glad it's gotten a lot better I still get hate mail every week, but it's a lot better than it used to be. I'm translating fewer death threats on Google Translate. I mean, that's,
I guess that's a win,
a step
right?
Forward. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, on one hand, it's great to know, hey, this stuff is being used in college classrooms. They're using my film in college classrooms, in high school classrooms, and in grad schools. It's been something for a lot of younger comics that they've seen as like, this is something that shaped me, which is strange, but is, I guess, true. And at the same time, you know, in a lot of ways, it hasn't done me favors because, you know, it's, to me, it's not that big a thing. I made this documentary, but it's not the center of my stand-up. My stand-up is usually about bigger issues regarding race and colonialism and sexism and justice. And this was like, you know, a film about an annoying thing when I was growing up. And so it also kind of, like, I guess you can't choose what makes you successful, right? There's always that kind of risk of being pigeonholed. So that's been a frustrating but motivating thing to do something else.
Yeah. Well, there's a bit of a Roger and Me vibe in the documentary because of this quest to talk with Hank Azaria, the white actor who created the voice of Apu. You talk in the film about how disappointing it was that he wouldn't agree to be part of the movie, but you finally did talk with him.
Yes.
For an episode of the NPR podcast Code Switch that aired just in April. What did that mean to you to finally be able to have that conversation with him?
I mean, the funny thing is we had spoken multiple times over the past year or so. We didn't for years after the film came out, and even before. I mean, we finally spoke when he emailed me out of the blue saying he wanted to get breakfast. And of course, I went in with some like apprehension, you know, and I'm sure he did too. But we had a nice hour-long chat, and we talked a couple of more times. And, you know, so I knew where a lot of his heart was, and the kinds of work he had done on himself, and the kinds of, you know, things he wanted to bring. That I knew that he, you know, had been working with anti-racist trainers. He'd studied a lot about, you know, white privilege, or what he refers to as relative advantage. I had, you know, I knew that he wanted to work with other white people and teach them what he has learned and really talk about how race in this country functions and how power and privilege function. And so, you know, immediately I'm blown away because that's not what I expected from this, you know, from this documentary, that it would lead to, you know, what he's taken from it. The conversation on Code Switch, though, was the first public conversation,
gotcha,
which was important because that was the goal. And there's a difference between being able to talk about it in private and making amends, or at least having a discussion, and publicly showing solidarity, right? Which is kind of what I wanted in the film. I wanted the film to end with Hank and I talking about this. And even if we don't come out to a resolution, we have a greater understanding of where each other was and where we are now. And I wanted that kind of beautiful ending of, this is what America could look like. And, you know, I didn't get it in the film, but it's wonderful to see us coming together later and for him to be able to share what he's learned. And also, I think for me, one thing that was important was, you know, for a long time, I saw him talking about what he learned on various podcasts and television shows, but he never mentioned me or never mentioned the documentary. Mm-hmm. And it almost felt like he kind of just learned this, which is something that a lot of white folks have done. It's taken the work of people of color and kind of taking it as their own, as if they just figured it out themselves. You know, there is no attribution. There is no sense of this journey was taken with other people who maybe had a harder time with it. And he kind of acknowledged that. He didn't acknowledge that in the Code Switch interview. And, you know, that was important to me because there's a lot of people of color who have done incredible work in so many different fields over the years. Mine is relatively small. And to know that, like, they don't get the due that they deserve is frustrating. So I appreciate that both personally and also as like a larger act of solidarity for people to see.
I've been talking with stand-up comedian and writer Hari Kondabolu. He'll be headlining a show at Taft Theater in downtown Cincinnati on Friday, June 9th. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.